Extract number 1. Read the questions.
Nine in the morning and Cassie is still in bed. Most schools have already started for the day, but Cassie's school now starts later, much later. It runs from 1:30 in the afternoon till 7 in the evening.
Morning, Mum.
Waking up later and getting more sleep has had a dramatic impact on life at home.
I used to get really annoyed for my mum trying to wake me up. I'm sorry. but now she doesn't really have to. I can just do it on my own.
I don't see her, you know, looking tired.
In my old school timetable, I felt kind of grumpy in the morning, but then it would wear out. But now it's just, I'm feeling good all around because I've got good sleep and good quality of sleep.
They've changed the start time at Cassie's school, not because they think their sixth formers are lazy. The decision's based on more than 20 years of research into the teenage body clock.
The cards really are stacked against them because they are overriding nature by getting up, quote, early in the morning in order to be on time for school.
Overriding nature, what is the science here? We ask the students to explain it.
In adolescence, as the brain continues to grow and develop, the body clock shifts to 2 to 3 hours later.
A 7 o'clock start time for a teenager is equivalent to a 4:30 wake-up time for an adult.
Schools on a day-to-day basis are dealing with a whole range of issues, sometimes mental health issues. I would argue there's a public health issue, really, in terms of a nation of teenagers, particularly older teenagers, that are going to school chronically sleep-deprived.
It's too early to say if the changes here will mean students do better in their exams, but it's hoped a wider study by Oxford University will help other schools to decide whether to change their timetable. Graeme Satchell, BBC News.
Now, listen again.
Nine in the morning and Cassie is still in bed. Most schools have already started for the day, but Cassie's school now starts later, much later. It runs from 1:30 in the afternoon till 7 in the evening.
Morning, Mum.
Waking up later and getting more sleep has had a dramatic impact on life at home.
I used to get really annoyed for my mum trying to wake me up. I'm sorry. but now she doesn't really have to. I can just do it on my own.
I don't see her, you know, looking tired.
In my old school timetable, I felt kind of grumpy in the morning, but then it would wear out. But now it's just, I'm feeling good all around because I've got good sleep and good quality of sleep.
They've changed the start time at Cassie's school, not because they think their sixth formers are lazy. The decision's based on more than 20 years of research into the teenage body clock.
The cards really are stacked against them because they are overriding nature by getting up, quote, early in the morning in order to be on time for school.
Overriding nature, what is the science here? We ask the students to explain it.
In adolescence, as the brain continues to grow and develop, the body clock shifts to 2 to 3 hours later.
A 7 o'clock start time for a teenager is equivalent to a 4:30 wake-up time for an adult.
Schools on a day-to-day basis are dealing with a whole range of issues, sometimes mental health issues. I would argue there's a public health issue, really, in terms of a nation of teenagers, particularly older teenagers, that are going to school chronically sleep-deprived.
It's too early to say if the changes here will mean students do better in their exams, but it's hoped a wider study by Oxford University will help other schools to decide whether to change their timetable. Graham Satchell, BBC News.
Extract number 2. Read the questions.
Dave Grohl, thank you so much for joining us on Channel 4 News. It's an absolute pleasure to have read the book as well. And the thing that really strikes you is you've got an incredible memory.
I'm surprised, too. I mean, of all the things that I've experienced or accomplished in my life, I do have a very vivid memory of all of these experiences. And I think one of the reasons why is because, you know, I kind of file these things or sort them in musical increments. So when I was young, if you play me a song from the 70s, I can remember vividly exactly where I was the first time I heard it, or what grade I was in, or what I was doing with my life at the time. And the same can be said for any album I've ever made. When I hear one of those songs come on the radio, I can remember what I was wearing at the time when I recorded it, what the studio looked like. And as I was writing the book, looking back, it's kind of flooded back really easily. So it was a joy to write. It was really fun.
I guess it also plays to the way you have learnt your music, because you didn't have formal drum lessons.
Yeah. I mean, first of all, the house that I grew up in, I think it was too small to have a drum set. I couldn't fit a drum set in my bedroom, and my mother surely wouldn't allow me to have it in the living room. So I was learning how to play music by ear. And with drums, I could decipher which was the kick drum, which was the snare drum, which was the rack tom, which was the ride cymbal. So it was just a matter of trying to figure out the physicality of doing that. But without having a drum set, I would set up these pillows on my bedroom floor and I would play along to records. I never had anyone telling me how to do it, what not to do. And I think in that, I kind of came up with my idea of drumming and how it should be done. It's like wild with inconsistencies, and I'm sure there's plenty of things that drum teachers would smack my hand for doing, but I appreciate doing it the way that I do it.
If you grew up listening to the Beatles and to American rock and roll, why was it that you became a punk rocker?
Well, when I was young, I had those rock and roll records, listening to the Beatles and AC/DC and Kiss and Led Zeppelin, things like that. And I had their posters on my walls, and I would look at these posters, and there's like smoke machines and lasers and dragons and cannons and, You know, to me, that was kind of rock and roll. But I'd never seen a live concert until I was about 13 years old. I took a family trip up to Chicago where my cousin Tracy was a punk rocker. And she took me to a club the first night we got there. And I saw a punk rock band in like a corner bar. There were maybe like 50 people there. And the band came on stage and the room just erupted. And I realized like, oh, maybe this is rock and roll. They only knew four chords. I'm like, I know those four chords. So maybe I could do this as well. And that's really what inspired me the most, was feeling that like, that it was accessible to me. I didn't have to have the dragons and the lasers and the smoke machines. All I really needed was like, you know, four chords and the truth, right?
You also mentioned watching the B-52s.
Yeah, so when I was young, in the 70s, the television show Saturday Night Live was, you know, it was on every weekend. It was a live sketch comedy show with musical guests. And the musical guests, getting to see these legends every weekend, and it was really diverse. Like one weekend it would be Peter Tosh, the next weekend it would be David Bowie. But there was this one weekend that the B-52s came on, and they were so eccentric and quirky and unusual. I somehow, for some reason, connected to it because I felt weird in my neighborhood. I felt like I was the eccentric, quirky, weird one. And when I saw the B-52s for the first time, I thought like, oh my God, you know, they're celebrating their eccentricity. They were doing it musically. I'm like, I'm a musician. I could do this as well. So seeing the B-52s for the first time on Saturday Night Live, it really did change my life because I felt like I understand them. They understand me. And, I didn't feel alone anymore. I thought, okay, maybe there's a world of weirdos like me out there. It was just a matter of trying to find them.
But if you started out as a weirdo and didn't want to sell out, you write really cleverly about the moment you hit the big time, really, watching Smells Like Teen Spirit on MTV.
Yeah. You know, the punk rock underground was kind of like ethically suffocating. You know, you were conditioned to reject any sort of commerciality or conformity. So then when your band becomes popular, like, what do you do? Like, how do you reconcile those two things? Or how do you justify that? You know, because most musicians feel some sort of guilt. Like you said, you use the word sellout. Like, what happens when the songs that you've written are loved by everyone? How do you deal with that? A lot of people feel this sense of guilt or shame. Like, oh no, I'm too popular. And it's difficult. I mean, it's one of the things that really affected Nirvana. None of us ever thought that we were going to be this gigantic band. But unfortunately, Kurt's songs were so good that millions and millions of people connected to it. And so you could either see it as a blessing or a celebration, or you could see it as some sort of curse. And there's this weird guilt and shame in that, which I think is really dangerous. I think it's dangerous because when you were young on your bedroom floor, there was no guilt then. When you're learning to play an instrument or learning to write songs, there's no guilt then. People talk about guilty pleasures. I don't believe in guilty pleasures. I believe that you should be able to say, I like this. And there should be nothing wrong with that. I remember when Gangnam Style came out. I wasn't ashamed to say, that's my favorite song of the year. I know I'm supposed to be this hardened punk rock, you know, heavy metal dude, but Gangnam Style is one of my favorite songs. Like, I should be able to say that, right? What's wrong with that? So I don't believe in the idea that guilt should be associated with the amount of people that listen to your music. If it's a beautiful song and the world wants to sing it, I think that you should sing it with them.
Now, listen again.
Dave Grohl, thank you so much for joining us on Channel 4 News. It's an absolute pleasure to have read the book as well. And the thing that really strikes you is you've got an incredible memory.
I'm surprised, too. I mean, of all the things that I've experienced or accomplished in my life, I do have a very vivid memory of all of these experiences. And I think one of the reasons why is because, you know, I kind of file these things or sort them in musical increments. So when I was young, if you play me a song from the 70s, I can remember vividly exactly where I was the first time I heard it or what grade I was in or what I was doing with my life at the time. And the same can be said for any album I've ever made. When I hear one of those songs come on the radio, I can remember what I was wearing at the time when I recorded it, what the studio looked like. And as I was writing the book, looking back, it's kind of flooded back really easily. So it was a joy to write. It was really fun.
I guess it also plays to the way you have learnt your music, because you didn't have formal drum lessons.
Yeah. First of all, the house that I grew up in, I think it was too small to have a drum set. I couldn't fit a drum set in my bedroom, and my mother surely wouldn't allow me to have it in the living room. So I was learning how to play music by ear. And with drums, I could decipher which was the kick drum, which was the snare drum, which was the rack tom, which was the ride cymbal. So it was just a matter of trying to figure out the physicality of doing that. But without having a drum set, I would set up these pillows on my bedroom floor and I would play along to records. I never had anyone telling me how to do it, what not to do. And I think in that, I kind of came up with my idea of drumming and how it should be done. It's like wild with inconsistencies, and I'm sure there's plenty of things that drum teachers would smack my hand for doing, but I appreciate doing it the way that I do it.
If you grew up listening to the Beatles and to American rock and roll, why was it that you became a punk rocker?
Well, when I was young, I had those rock and roll records, listening to the Beatles and AC/DC and Kiss and Led Zeppelin, things like that. And I had their posters on my walls, and I would look at these posters, and there's like smoke machines and lasers and dragons and cannons. And, you know, to me, that was kind of rock and roll. But I'd never seen a live concert until I was about 13 years old. I took a family trip up to Chicago where my cousin Tracy was a punk rocker. And she took me to a club the first night we got there, and I saw a punk rock band in like a corner bar. There were maybe like 50 people there. And the band came on stage, and the room just erupted. And I realized, like, oh, maybe this is rock and roll. They only knew four chords. I'm like, I know those four chords, so maybe I could do this as well. And that's really what inspired me the most, was feeling that, like, that it was accessible to me. I didn't have to have the dragons and the lasers and the smoke machines. All I really needed was, like, you know, four chords and the truth, right?
You also mentioned watching the B-52s.
Yeah, so when I was young, in the 70s, the television show Saturday Night Live was, you know, it was on every weekend. It was a live sketch comedy show with musical guests. And the musical guests, getting to see these legends every weekend, and it was really diverse. Like, one weekend it would be Peter Tosh. The next weekend it would be David Bowie. But there was this one weekend that the B-52s came on, and they were so eccentric and quirky and unusual. I somehow, for some reason, connected to it, because I felt weird in my neighborhood. I felt like I was the eccentric, quirky, weird one. And when I saw the B-52s for the first time, I thought, like, oh my God, you know, they're celebrating their eccentricity. They were doing it musically. I'm like, I'm a musician. I could do this as well. So seeing the B-52s for the first time on Saturday Night Live, it really did change my life, because I felt like I understand them. They understand me. And I didn't feel alone anymore. I thought, okay, maybe there's a world of weirdos like me out there. It was just a matter of trying to find them.
But if you started out as a weirdo and didn't want to sell out, you write really cleverly about the moment you hit the big time, really, watching Smells Like Teen Spirit on MTV.
Yeah. You know, the punk rock underground was kind of like ethically suffocating. You know, you were conditioned to reject any sort of commerciality or conformity. So then when your band becomes popular, like, what do you do? Like, how do you reconcile those two things? Or how do you justify that? You know, because most musicians feel some sort of guilt. Like you said, you use the word sellout. Like, what happens when the songs that you've written are loved by everyone? How do you deal with that? A lot of people feel this sense of guilt or shame. Like, oh no, I'm too popular. And it's difficult. I mean, it's one of the things that really affected Nirvana. None of us ever thought that we were going to be this gigantic band. But unfortunately, Kurt's songs were so good that millions and millions of people connected to it. And so you could either see it as a blessing or a celebration, or you could see it as some sort of curse. And there's this weird guilt and shame in that, which I think is really dangerous. I think it's dangerous because when you were young on your bedroom floor, there was no guilt then. When you're learning to play an instrument or learning to write songs, there's no guilt then. People talk about guilty pleasures. I don't believe in guilty pleasures. I believe that you should be able to say, I like this. And there should be nothing wrong with that. I remember when Gangnam Style came out. I wasn't ashamed to say, that's my favorite song of the year. I know I'm supposed to be this hardened punk rock, heavy metal dude, but Gangnam Style is one of my favorite songs. Like, I should be able to say that, right? What's wrong with that? So I don't believe in the idea that guilt should be associated with the amount of people that listen to your music. If it's a beautiful song and the world wants to sing it, I think that you should sing it with them.
That is the end of part 1.